The Bob Murphy Show, episode 317.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome back to The Bob Murphy Show. Today I'm going solo, and this is due to a listener request. Somebody wanted me to go over the latest economic data, including the jobs data. All right, so what I'm not going to like literally go through the latest jobs report and unpack the growth in the hospitality sector and the blah, blah, blah. And I'm not going to do that, but I am going to give just an overview of how I take the pulse of the macro economy. All right, so you can either like this or dislike it, but let me just tell you the way I'm looking at things right now. And in particular, the last thing I'll do at the end of this episode is revisit the stuff I've been writing on the yield curve for a while, because it's at this point become conventional wisdom that, oh yeah, economists thought there was going to be a recession for a while, but that was clearly wrong. And so now who knows what the heck's going to happen. And I'm still sticking to my guns, and I'll explain, you know, there's some nuance, but I'm going to explain at the end of this why I still think that analysis holds up and that we shouldn't just assume, oh yeah, the economists who thought there was going to be a recession have obviously been repudiated by the data. All right. So the first thing I want to talk about is inflation, or what's more accurately from an Austrian perspective described as consumer price inflation. Oh, I should mention for this stuff, I'm going to have an accompanying article that I'm going to write up for my weekly post at the Infineo website. So if you go to bobmurphyshow.com/317, which is this episode's number, you'll see a link to that if you want to see the charts and, you know, see my written analysis of the kind of stuff I'm going to summarize right now. Also, if you're listening to the audio of this, if you want to, I'm going to, for the YouTube version of this episode of The Bob Murphy Show, I will have them splice in the charts that I'm going to be referring to. So basically what's going to happen for this episode is I'm going to be walking through three different main topics, referring to Fred charts that are graphing, you know, variables that are relevant to the topic at hand. So if you want to actually see the charts as I'm discussing them, like I say, go to the YouTube version. So if you're listening to the audio, if you go to bobmurphyshow.com/317, you'll see a link for the YouTube version of this episode. Okay. So anyway, our good friend Stephanie Kelton, recently when the CPI came out and it was, quote, hotter than expected. And so Stephanie Kelton tweeted out and said, "The numbers have been kind to the thesis that raising rates might move inflation higher." So the context here is, conventional economic wisdom says that when the Fed wants to tighten, they raise rates, and that should put downward pressure on prices to cool off the economy, and vice versa. Uh-oh, if unemployment is ticking up and the economy looks like it's slowing down, and from a Keynesian point of view, that means aggregate demand is not adequate. What does the Fed do? Oh, it needs to loosen. So what does that mean? Oh, it cuts rates to stimulate spending. And that should push up inflationary pressures, right? So that's the conventional view. And as you can imagine, from an Austrian perspective, that I don't agree with that. But what's weird is the MMTers are like, their critique of the wrong theory is itself wrong. So the enemy of my enemy is my enemy. All right, so the prima facie, so my reaction to her tweet, I retweeted her saying that and said, "I'm not trolling. Everyone, I beg of you, look at this chart." As Fed began raising rates, red line, year-over-year consumer inflation, blue line, started falling. Then they both stabilized at just about the same time. And yet Kelton's running victory laps saying the opposite. All right, so I realize if you can't see the chart, it's not as poignant. But my point is, the chart shows just about the exact opposite of what Kelton is claiming. All right, so specifically, when the federal funds rate, which is, you know, the direct rate that the Fed targets, we went into the corona panic and the Fed cut rates down to basically zero and then held them there for 2 years and then started raising rates pretty aggressively. And so while the rates were down at zero, the year-over-year growth in the CPI, at first it came crashing down, you know, when COVID first hit, and then it started zooming up. And zoom is the right word. It broke above 8% year-over-year. All right, and all along the way, people like Krugman were saying, oh, it's transitory. Don't worry. The Fed doesn't need to raise rates. That'll, you know, strangle the economy. This is just transitory. This is just supply side bottlenecks. Don't worry. And Krugman kept claiming that inflation had peaked, and he kept being wrong. He was so wrong that he actually admitted he was wrong. And then when the dust settled and time passed, then he went back to saying he was right all along. But there was a brief period where it was so bad for Krugman, he actually had to admit he was wrong about what was going on with inflation in print. Okay, it's a very rare thing. Okay, so again, just looking at the chart, while rates were down at zero, where the conventional, you know, old school standard economic description would be, oh, the Fed, in order to goose the economy, to boost spending, to help a depressed economy, needs to cut rates to zero in order to have a loose monetary policy and stimulate. That's what they were doing, right? Cut rates down to zero. And inflation zoomed up to the highest it's been in 40 years. And then the Fed started hiking rates aggressively, and then inflation came crashing down. And then inflation eventually stabilized. And when did inflation stabilize? When the Fed stopped raising rates. Okay, so if your theory were pulling rates down to zero causes inflation, and by inflation, I mean consumer price inflation, to go up, and then raising rates makes inflation start coming down, and then to stabilize rates makes inflation stop moving and just itself tread water, the chart shows that perfectly. And so then Kelton comes along and says, you know, the numbers have been kind to the thesis that raising rates might move inflation higher. When no, the data clearly show as the Fed raised rates, inflation collapsed. Not it ticked down a few notches. No, it collapsed. And when did inflation zoom up? When interest rates were zero. Okay, so no, the numbers have not been kind to that thesis at all. They have been wicked to that. They have been brutal to that thesis. They're the meanest numbers around. They're bullies to that thesis. That thesis is crying in the corner, calling up its mom and saying, come pick me up. These numbers are being mean to me. Okay. Now, having said all that, I am not advancing the thesis that there's a simple mechanical process that, oh, when Fed pushes down interest rates, that means CPI growth goes up and vice versa. I'm not saying that. Yes, the actual causality is more complicated. I personally think really the reason for that superficial analysis or correlation is that when we say, well, how does the Fed raise rates or cut rates? Certainly back in the day, it was because they altered the rate of money growth. And so if the Fed wanted to ease and make, quote, money easier and to push rates down, it would buy bonds, flood the banking sector with more reserves, and that would push down the overnight interest rate on reserves, which is what the federal funds rate is. And then going the other way, if the Fed thinks, uh-oh, the economy's overheating, we better take our foot off the gas, well, then it would do the opposite. It would either slow the rate of asset purchase, slow the rate of the growth of the Fed's balance sheet, or if they really wanted to be aggressive about it, they would actually sell assets off, or as their assets, as the bonds on their portfolio matured, they just wouldn't roll them over, so they would suck reserves on net out of the system as their balance sheet shrunk. And so then that would, on the margin, other things equal, raise the equilibrium price of borrowing those reserves as the supply fell. Okay? And so you can have situations like in Zimbabwe, when the central bank is dumping money into the economy, interest rates, I haven't gone and looked this up, but I'm sure once that process was underway, I'm sure nominal interest rates were quite high because people were building in price inflation expectations. So even though the Zimbabwe central bank had a, quote, very easy monetary policy, the nominal absolute level of interest rates was probably really high because, you know, if you were going to borrow money today and then pay it back next year, well, if the price level in general went up 1,000 times in that interval, obviously the interest rate would have to reflect that. Okay, and then the other going the other way, if the central bank is really tight, like let's say it just slams the brakes and just freezes the quantity of money at the current level, like the stock of money, and just holds there for 5 years. I bet at the end of that 5-year period, if everyone thought the policy was going to continue, I bet nominal interest rates would be quite low. Right? Even though that would be a very tight monetary policy because people would have adjusted the actual and expected near-term future rates of consumer price inflation in that environment would be probably negative. All right. And so if you're going to lend someone $100 and know that when they pay you back next year, prices in general are probably going to be 2 or 3% lower than they are now, then you don't need to get 6% extra on your principal because in general, you're going to get a 3% return just because of the falling prices. Okay. So, all right. So, and this is kind of a point like that Milton Friedman would make, and that's, you know, Scott Sumner has, you know, had a spawned a cottage industry on those insights. Okay. So I think he misapplied it that Scott Sumner said during the rounds of QE following the financial crisis that Ben Bernanke had the tightest monetary policy since the Hoover administration. And that, oh, don't just because interest rates got cut to zero, that doesn't mean anything. So Sumner's right. In principle, you can imagine interest rates dropping to low levels, even though the central bank has a very tight policy. I just think that, no, in that case, the Bernanke Fed was not having a tight policy when it was doubling the balance sheet in 6 months or whatever it did. Okay, but anyway, so I'm making those distinctions. My point here is, so I realize I'm jumping around. Sorry, folks. Kelton is not saying what I'm saying, though. She's not saying, hey, just because the Fed started raising rates in, what, early 2022, and that's when consumer price inflation started coming down fast, don't be fooled because there's something else going on behind the scenes. That's not what she's arguing. She's not arguing that money growth is the, you know, the hidden variable that's affecting both of, no, what she's arguing is when interest rates go up in an environment where there's a huge stock of government debt, then now the government has to make a higher volume of interest payments. And so in the MMT framework, oh, that's new money being added to the economy, right? The net financial assets of the economy are going up, other things equal. when the federal government has to make a higher volume of interest payments on the debt as interest rates rise. And so that's what's propping up the economy and pushing prices higher. All right. So in the MMT framework, yes, other things equal, that's true. But that doesn't matter. It like the total, like I say, so if you're curious though, to say, okay, what is going off the monetary stock, Bob? M2, the growth rate of M2 zoomed way up after, you know, when COVID first set in, and then it came crashing down, and it actually went negative year over year in November of 2022. All right. And as of this latest data reading that I'm looking at, I'm recording this in April of 2024, year over year M2 growth is still negative, right? So M2 right now is lower than it was 12 months ago. By the way, that's very rare. All right, normally what happens is in a typical business cycle, M2 grows during the boom and then the growth tapers off. But it's not like M2 actually starts shrinking, you know, in the bust. But this time around, M2 growth was so explosive. It got higher than, it got up to like 28% or something year over year, that when they slammed the brakes, M2 actually came down, right? So they dumped so much money into the system when the pandemic hit that now reversing course, they're actually on net sucking money out of the system. Okay. And so looking at those measures, it's a decent fit where, so I graph the percent, you know, the year-over-year change in the CPI against the year-over-year change in M2. And, you know, they're not, when I say they match, I don't mean they're identical. What I mean, though, is the shape is the same, right? So M2 growth is typically higher than CPI growth, which makes sense that, you know, if real output is rising, right? So like if the money stock grows 5%, but real output grows 3%, well, then you don't expect prices to go up 2%. All right, I'm keeping the arithmetic simple. It's a little bit more subtle than that if you are a math geek, but you get the idea. Okay, but what I'm saying is from like 2011 through 2019, those two things, you know, the general shape of those two series is about the same. There's just a gap between them where M2 is a bit higher than CPI. And then going into the COVID crisis, M2, like I say, zooms way up and CPI growth at first dips down. But then CPI starts rising rapidly, and then M2 peaks, comes crashing down, and then soon after CPI peaks and comes down pretty fast. And when I say M2 and CPI, I mean year-over-year growth. Okay, so if you thought M2 was the driver of CPI with a bit of a lag, it roughly matches. Okay, and it even in terms of like the bottoming out and stuff, that M2 bottoms out, that, you know, the fall, and then starts bouncing back up, and the same thing with CPI. It's year over year chart comes down pretty fast, bottoms out, and then even starts dipping up a little bit. Okay, so again, it's not totally, you know, perfect, but it doesn't look like a physical relationship if you were looking at something in the lab or something, but it's not bad. It's certainly, I think the numbers have been far kinder to the theory or the thesis that changes in M2 growth drive changes in CPI than what Kelton's saying. Okay. Incidentally, it was funny. I tweeted my statement or retweeted hers with my comment, my sarcastic commentary. Actually, it wasn't even sarcasm. I was actually just being straight on this one. And as you can imagine, my fans applauded me. MMT morons. And I was, I mean, it was so such a slam dunk to me. I was wondering, like, what the heck are the MMT people even going to say? And they were coming. Now, some, in fairness, were more nuanced. And they weren't even actually, take that back. Some of the nuanced people were not MMTers. They were basically saying, like, Bob, I'm not defending Kelton, but in fairness, and they were saying, you know, there were other shocks going on. There's things like there were supply chain bottleneck issues or one guy made the fair point that, well, if you look at monthly CPI changes, it came down fast, but you could say that's because the supply bottlenecks after the, you know, the lockdowns eased up. And then it seems like CPI inflation is higher than we would have thought, given how high interest rates are, right? In other words, if you had said 6 months ago, hey, the Fed's going to raise rates up to whatever it is, 5.3%, and keep them there, and what do you think inflation is going to do? That a lot of economists would have thought, oh, it's going to keep ticking down, and eventually the Fed's going to have to start cutting. Otherwise, we're going to get back into dangerous territory of possible deflation. And so economists would not have expected CPI to kind of get stuck, you know, in the 3% range or whatever it is right now, in terms of like the monthly change at an annualized rate. Okay, so again, that's getting in the weeds, but fair enough with all those points. But again, my basic argument is if Kelton wanted to say, hey, the data don't completely rule out the possibility that raising rates actually makes inflation higher, you know, that would have been fine. But she didn't. She said the numbers have been kind to the thesis that raising rates might move inflation higher. And again, I want to say, no, prima facie, rates were very, you know, rates were zero. Inflation went up to 40-year highs. The Fed, against the advice of people like Kelton and Krugman, jacked rates up aggressively. Inflation came down. And then the Fed stopped raising rates, and then inflation stabilized. Not at a historically low rate, I grant you, but also not at a super high rate. And the other thing, too, is having the federal funds rate at 5.3%, that's not like that's some historically super high rate. That's just high compared to what we've been used to the last 10 years, right? It's not like short-term interest rates at 5% and change is some crazy draconian policy. It's just we've gotten so spoiled by having rates at zero. Like just recently, Japan finally had interest rates that weren't negative. And everyone's like, oh, what's this? A new dawn in Japan. Okay, so anyway, it's amazing to me just how like they're so locked into their worldview and their framework that they're running victory laps when it's like, no, actually, if you step back and look at the chart, this is not at all consistent with what you said. Or it doesn't illustrate what you said, I'll put it that way. All right. So it doesn't prove she's wrong, but it certainly does not make her look right, put it that way. This is way more consistent with the standard orthodox theory.
Hey, folks, let's take a break from the action to talk about our sponsor for today, Monetary Metals. Now, we all know the dollar's losing value because of inflation, and we all know that owning gold protects your wealth from eroding away. But one of the biggest objections to owning gold is that it just sits there. There's no yield. It doesn't pay you any interest or dividends. In fact, you have to pay fees to store and insure it. But what if you could actually earn interest on gold? Well, that's exactly what Monetary Metals offers. With Monetary Metals, you can earn between 2% to 5% on your gold and silver every year. And if you're an accredited investor, you're eligible to earn even higher yields. But how does it work? How are they able to pay interest on gold? And let me say, folks, this part of their business model, it took me a bit to understand. After all, I thought, it's not like physical gold bars turn into more gold bars a year later. So how could they reliably promise you a return denominated in physical gold? Well, here's how it works. Monetary Metals connects you and your ounces with companies that need physical gold inventory for their business, such as jewelers, mints, refineries, bullion dealers, and more. The businesses need gold, and Monetary Metals lets you rent your gold to these qualified businesses. Now, in a more conventional arrangement, a jeweler, for example, might buy raw gold at its market price, fashion it into necklaces, rings, and so on, and then down the road sell the finished products. But this more conventional model involves risk for the jeweler, because the price of gold can drop in the interim, meaning they won't be able to sell the necklaces, rings, and so on for what they originally forecasted. If they had relied on a loan, quoted in dollars, to finance their initial purchase of the raw gold, they might be unable to pay back their creditors. But with Monetary Metals on the scene, there's another option. Now these businesses get the gold they need to use in their own business without being exposed to gold price risk. The jeweler, for example, borrows the raw gold at the start and promises a markup in physical gold. Then, no matter what happens to the spot price of gold, the jeweler's built-in margin from transforming raw gold into earrings, rings, and so on, kicks in and allows him to pay back his loan after the final sale. The jeweler benefits, and you get to put your gold to work for a regularly monthly income in gold. It's a win-win. Now, when I say interest on gold paid in gold, I mean it. It's actually paid in ounces of gold. For example, let's say you start out with 100 ounces and the interest rate is 3% annual. That means you will be earning 3 additional ounces of gold every year, regardless of what the spot price of gold does during the year. You just watch your total gold ounces grow every month and leverage the power of compound interest, but measured in ounces of physical gold and silver. So let's recap. Why would you earn interest in dollars, which are constantly losing value, when you can earn interest in gold? Go to www.monetary-metals.com/Murphy to learn more or to get started opening an account. In case you're wondering, I've opened an account with them myself, and my gold is now growing more gold at Monetary Metals. So again, go to monetary-metals.com/Murphy to get started growing your gold too. Okay, let's get back to the show. Okay, what about employment? So here, let me apologize to you folks. I kind of blundered on this, and I realize in retrospect what happened. So somehow I had gotten it into my mind that the labor market participation rate was back to pre-pandemic levels, and that, you know, the economy was basically, so I had erroneously thought that, yeah, for a while the low unemployment rate was misleading because the labor force participation rate was low. So let's take a quick tangent just to understand how these numbers work. So the unemployment rate is looking at how many people are trying to find a job and can't get one, that number divided by the number of people in the labor force. Okay, so the numerator is the number of people who are trying to find a job, or the number of people who want to be working and can't get a job. And then that's divided by the number of people who want to be working and can't find a job, plus the number of people who want to be working and have a job, right? And so it's not looking at people who aren't working and just gave up. All right, so that's the critical thing. So that's why the fact that we have a low unemployment rate, and we do by historical standards, unemployment rate is very low, that by itself doesn't mean the economy is great. Because, as you know, as many critics have pointed out, and this really kicked in after the financial crisis hit. So in the Obama years, even when the unemployment rate started coming down and didn't look as awful, a lot of critics were pointing out saying that's misleading. It's because the job market was so bleak that a lot of people just gave up. And so the way that the government counts the unemployed is they send out, you know, questionnaires or whatever to randomly selected households or businesses or whatever, depending on the survey. And and someone has to say, I'm actively looking for work, but I'm unemployed. And then that's how they get counted. If someone says, I'm not actively looking for work, then they're no longer in the numerator to calculate the unemployment rate. Okay. So that was definitely true for years.
And that was a standard talking point that people like on Fox News or who want to bash Obama and now Biden would bring out. And I was fine with that. But then I was checking the numbers and somehow I had gotten it into my head that, oh, actually the economy has sufficiently recovered that that's not really an asterisk anymore. And the unemployment rate really is, you know, it's as meaningful now as it would have been in 2005. And so I thought, and so the reason I'm just giving you guys this mea culpa is I think I probably said that on a podcast or something, maybe not here on the Bob Murphy Show, but I think I might've said that elsewhere. And I realized as I was going over the numbers for this episode that, no, that's not right. That it's still the case that, so a better measure that takes into account that quirk is the employment population ratio. So what this measure looks at, it doesn't care whether someone's actively seeking work or not. It just says flat out what percentage of the total population is employed. Okay, so here, the higher the number, the better, if you like people working. And so that number right now is lower. So right now it's the March 2024 figure is 60.3%. So 60.3% of the population was working. And on the right before the crash going into the pandemic lockdowns and stuff, the highest number was January 2022 and it was 61.1%. All right. But even there, what happened was the overall, if you just look at the chart of this thing, you know, going back to the 50s, it was, you know, it was basically stable except for business cycles, but it was bouncing around. And then, in a fairly stable range between 55 and 58%, let's say. And then it went up pretty much, you know, hit new highs in the 70s, then came crashing down with the recession in the early 80s. And then in the 80s, it went way up to 63% and then came down in the recession in the early 90s. And then it went way up again in the 90s. And it peaked in April of 2000 at 64.7%. And then it came down that recession, bounced back a little bit, but it never regained its previous high. And then it fell off a cliff going into the great financial crisis of 2008. And it bottomed out at 58.2% in November of 2010. And then during the Obama years and then the Trump years, it slowly marched back up, but it only regained about half of the lost ground, you know, of what it lost during the steep crash after the financial crisis. And then again, it really plummeted for COVID, you know, briefly, and then bounced back, but it didn't even recover to the pre-pandemic level. Okay, so again, this kind of a thing, if you could see the chart and not just listen to me talking about it, it would be more meaningful to you. But my point is, you have to go, you know, so there was the big crash right after 2008, and then it came up and bounced above that and then crashed again. But at the current level, except for that, you know, crossover after the 2008 crash, you have to go all the way back to like 1985 to get to a point at which the employment population ratio was as low as it is right now. All right. So from that perspective, it's like, ooh, like the percentage of the economy who are working is the lowest it's been, again, absent just a few years following the catastrophe of the financial crisis, but it's the lowest it's been. Well, what's that, 40 years. All right. Now, unfortunately, even this, though, is a little bit misleading, too, because the population has aged over the last 40 years. Okay, so that's something that you would expect, even if we had Ancapistan and the population aged, you would expect, as you know, in other words, a higher proportion of the population right now is retired than was the case in 1985. So the on its own, merely the fact that a lower percentage of the population right now is employed than was the case, you know, in 1995 or something, that per se does not mean that, oh, something's wrong with the labor market. Okay, so don't get me wrong. I think something is wrong with the labor market, but I'm just saying these numbers I'm citing in this chart of the employment population ratio, the fact that it peaked in the late 90s and then, you know, has just steadily been drifting downward over time with massive crashes and then slightly recoveries superimposed on that general decline, that per se doesn't mean disaster. So ideally what I wanted, and I tried to find this for you folks, but I couldn't nail it down in time before I had to record this. Really what I would like to see, just to show you how I think about this stuff, another problem is employment. Like, what if someone just working part-time, right? So that's the issue too. So really what I wanted to see, if I had a perfect statistic for the kind of thing I have in mind, is I would want to look at something like, so they had this thing called prime age employment years. So that's people aged 25 to 54 is one popular, you know, chunk of the age range to use. So if you just think that through, like, that's pretty good, right? Because people in their, you know, people 22, 23, they might be in grad school or something. So maybe they're not counted as working. You know, that's not necessarily a sign of a sick economy. But, and as people get older, you know, maybe they phase out how much they work or something. Somebody 62, maybe you're semi-retired or whatever. But between the ages of 25 and 54, those are the prime working years. And so what I really wanted to see was, for that age bracket, how many hours per week on average did the people that age work? And then look at that statistic over time. And, you know, for me, that would be a much better metric than just the, you know, the raw unemployment rate or even the employment population ratio or even the employment rate of the people who are 25 to 54. Because like I said, that could mask what if right now a bunch of them are working only part-time. Like if they're only working 20 hours a week when they would like to work 40. So maybe they're still counted as employed, but they're not as employed as they were back in 1998, if you get what I'm saying. So that's why, strictly speaking, my perfect metric would be something like the average number of hours worked per week per person who was in the 25 to 54 age range. And then that statistic annually going back 40 years. I would love to see something like that. It even ideally broken out by male and female, because that's another thing. So partly why I think the employment population ratio went up from, you know, the mid-70s and peaked in the late 90s is I think you had a lot of women coming into the formal labor force who before didn't work. And you could either say that's a good thing or a bad thing, right? So feminists would say it's a good thing. Other people would say it's a bad thing. And to the extent, if they were doing it, like even just economically, oh, because of tax rate cuts in the 80s. And so on the margin, it made sense for, you know, a couple to get childcare so the wife could work more instead of staying home with the kids. Like maybe that made sense. Whereas with, you know, higher tax rates on the margin, that wouldn't make sense, that even if the wife went and worked, and they only got to keep 60% of it, and then you had to hire the nanny or whatever. That's stupid. Whereas if they get to keep 85% of it on the margin, well, then maybe it does make sense. You know, okay, so that kind of deal. All right, so all that stuff, like I say, I would like to tease out. So the statistic I set up before, but even broken down by sex, that would be even more informative. Okay, but again, I looked, and that data is not readily available, to my understanding. Okay, last thing we'll talk about in this episode, the yield curve stuff. Okay, so for a while, and if you haven't seen it, I'll link in the show notes page, but I have been predicting a recession. And when I say for a while, I don't mean like for the last 3 years. I've been saying, oh, recession next Thursday, recession next Thursday, recession next Thursday, and I keep moving the goalpost. I don't think I've done that. All right, I may have it wouldn't surprise me, put it this way, if I have in the past said at this point the recession might have started by now, but we wouldn't have known it yet. I'm sure I've said stuff like that, but I don't think I've said something with this yield curve stuff, whereas at this point, that earlier prediction is now wrong, if you get what I'm saying. All right. So I was giving windows. So I'm sure the earliest time I started speaking about the yield curve being inverted, if we were right now seeing 6% unemployment, it's not like I would have been like, yeah, see, I told you. Right. So that's true. But I don't think the fact that unemployment right now is still only in 3% range, that means I said something that is demonstrably false, I believe. I'm sure my critics can go dig up stuff. But let me admit, what is true is when I was giving estimates of when I thought the recession would be officially underway. And by the way, I always would cover myself by saying it takes time for the government officials to ex post recognize that, yes, we are in a recession. All right, so for example, the great financial crisis recession, that didn't officially begin until December 2007, right? Remember, the financial crisis actually wasn't until the fall of 2008. So that recession, the way they clocked it, was in December 2007. People didn't know there was a recession, or the government didn't say there was a recession at that point, right? It's actually funny. The Fed had a meeting and Janet Yellen was there. She wasn't chair at the time. Bernanke was. And she was saying the economy might be headed into a recession soon, whereas other people were more bullish. And then later when Yellen was the Fed chair, her fans were like, oh yeah, she called it. And it was like, she was being congratulated that even though the recession had already begun, she was saying, well, it might begin soon. Whereas her peers thought, no, everything's fine. It's not like any of them said, oh yeah, I think right now we're in a recession, even though that was the case. Okay. So that's just, there's always the lags with these things. All right. So even if we were in a recession right now, they wouldn't be able to definitively say that until later. Cause there's, like I say, there's a lag in the data. But anyway, partly what's going on is, so historically, the yield curve has inverted, meaning the metric I like to use is the 10-year yield, the yield on 10-year U.S. Treasuries minus the 3-month Treasury bond yield, okay? And so in a normal environment, the yield curve is upward sloping. The interest rate on a 10-year government bond is higher than on a 3-month one. And so, the one subtracted from the other is usually a positive number, but it does happen where the yield on a 3-month T-bill is higher than on a 10-year bond. Okay. And then, so that's what we mean when we say the yield curve is inverted. So since the 1960s, it's been almost perfect where a yield curve inversion is soon followed by a recession, and every recession has had an inversion preceding it, right? So there's no false negatives, no false positives, except there's like one borderline case where I think the yield curve inverted and there wasn't technically a recession, but there was an economic slowdown, right? So it was, the pattern was still there that a yield curve inversion led to a sharp slowdown, but they didn't technically classify it as a recession. Okay, so that's the pattern. So we have had ever since, let's look at the data here. Between October 2022 going into November 2022, the yield curve officially inverted. If we're looking at the 10-year and 3-month monthly averages is what I'm looking at. Okay, so that thing officially went negative back, like I say, in the fall of 2022. So it's been inverted for a long time. And so that's, and by the way, it's not mere correlations and just looking at charts. Like I with Ryan Griggs, published a peer-reviewed paper in an Austrian journal on this phenomenon, and we gave it foundations in Austrian business cycle theory. So if you believe in Mises' theory of what causes the boom-bust cycle, a corollary of that is that the yield curve would at least become more shallow before a recession. Like, just qualitatively, you wouldn't be able to say that it would invert, but it definitely would make sense that during a boom period, the yield curve would be steeper, and then it would flatten out going into recession. And so it's not surprising that empirically it actually literally inverts. All right. So we spell all that out if you're curious. So I'm not just looking at charts and prognosticating. It theoretically makes sense from an Austrian framework. Okay. So because of all that, when the yield curve inverted, and then it deeply inverted. All right. So the yield curve, the gap between the 3-month and the 10-year yield was much stronger or bigger than it was going back at least the last 4 recessions, like a lot bigger. Okay. And so I thought, okay, that's a very strong signal that leads me to believe, and it all makes sense too, right? Like, the Fed did a crazy amount of monetary easing, pumped in a ton of money after the, when Corona hit, because the changes in the monetary base were much more than the M2 changes I was mentioning before. Like, so in terms of the direct, what the Fed did with its balance sheet and pumping in reserves and stuff like that was, dwarfed even what they did under Bernanke and during the QE phases. Okay. So from an Austrian perspective, I was arguing it's not surprising the Fed just has an unprecedented inflation surge and then pulls that out, because the Fed did let its balance sheet start falling. It's not surprising that you'd get a crash, in real output. And so that was lining up with the fact that the yield curve was deeply inverted. I was like, oh yeah, this pattern is going to hold up again. And so I've been explaining the pattern and then saying, so this leads me to believe a recession's in store. And then I was giving a forecast of when I thought the recession would be in motion, or when it would be in effect. And what I was doing is I was looking at the historical pattern to see, once the yield curve inverts, how long before the recession kicks in. And then using that pattern, it's not the same for every recession, but I was kind of getting the ballpark of, in general, what is it? And then, what's the longest it took, and then what's the shortest, and so that's what I was using. But what's happened is, right now, for this inversion, it has lasted a lot longer than all the previous ones. So if what your theory is that, let me put it this way. The yield curve, historically, the pattern is, yes, it inverts and there's a recession, but usually it uninverts. I think always it uninverts before the recession actually begins. Okay. So strictly speaking, the pattern has not just been, oh yeah, every time since the 60s that the yield curve has inverted, then there's soon been a recession. It's that the yield curve has inverted, then it has reverted back to upward sloping, where the 10-year yield's higher than the 3-month, and then a recession kicks in shortly thereafter. So the fact that right now the yield curve has been deeply inverted and a recession hasn't begun, strictly speaking, hasn't violated the pattern. Really, what you'd want to see to be able to say, oh yeah, that pattern was totally not the case this time around, is you'd want the yield curve to revert, to go back to being upward sloping, and then have 2 years go by with no recession. Then you could clearly say, yes, this was a counterexample to that pattern. So the fact that a recession hasn't clearly begun yet and unemployment's still 3% and change, that is in no way embarrassing to the people who think the yield curve inversion is a strong, indicator of an impending recession. Because again, it hasn't gone back. Having said all that, though, if it stays inverted like this for another year, then that's definitely going to throw off my earlier prognostications when I was trying to give a timetable when the recession might kick in. Because again, I was basing it off of when the thing first went negative. Okay. So anyway, now coming back to, so what does that mean? Why has it stayed so inverted? So here I can't really, so what I did is I looked at a chart. And again, if you're looking at the video now, it will have switched to that. There's this other chart that I'm looking at. So what I did is instead of just looking at the spread, you know, the 10-year minus the 3-month, I broke them out individually. So I've charted the 10-year as its own line and then the 3-month as its own line to be able to see. And I think really it's just a matter of in the previous recessions, the 3-month has aggressively moved up. And so, by the way, this is the way I would blow up Krugman's explanation. So the way Krugman explained the pattern of an inverted yield curve sort of gives a signal of an impending recession is he just made it all about expectations. He said, oh, you know, people who really follow the markets and stuff have boots on the ground. They know if the economy's starting to turn, you know, they have access to that information. People who, you know, buy and sell stocks and whatever, that's their livelihood. They need to know that. And so once the market starts anticipating there's going to be a recession in the near future, they also anticipate that the Fed's going to have to cut short rates, right? Because the Fed has more control over short-term interest rates. So once the recession is fully underway, the Fed's going to start cutting going into that. So right now, if we see that coming, even though short rates right now are still high, we think eventually the Fed's going to cut short rates. So those expectations get built into the long-term rate, right? So right now, if I think starting 2 years from now, the Fed's going to sharply start cutting one-year rates, then what I pay right now for a 10-year bond is going to be affected by those expectations. All right, so that's the idea. So that's Krugman's explanation for why it is that you see 3-month yields higher than 10-year yields a year before a recession officially begins. But that's just the data doesn't hold that up, or don't hold that up, because data is plural. Data are plural. Wait, no, data, the word is plural. Okay. What you actually see empirically is going into a recession, what happens is, you know, you're in a boom period where short-term rates are low and long-term rates are, you know, normal. And then the Fed starts tightening, so short rates zoom up, and then they briefly overshoot above the long rate, and then they both start coming down, and then the recession begins. All right, so it's the reason for the inversion typically is not that short-term rates are just doing their thing and then long rates come down and break the barrier as they fall. No, it's first short rates zoom up as the Fed tightens. They dip above briefly the 10-year yield, and then, like I say, they both start coming down. But the 3-month falls faster than the 10, and that's why the yield curve goes back to normal. Okay? So, and that's why I say it's consistent with Austrian business cycle theory, that what's causing the switch from the boom to the bust is the Fed tightening. So that totally makes sense. It's not just that people are anticipating. Because also there's some weirdness too about, like, oh, people look to the yield curve to get some information about if there's going to be a recession. And why does the yield curve seem to know? Oh, because everyone knows a recession's coming. And so they reflect it in bond prices, right? So, I mean, I'm being a bit glib. They're, you know, prices can communicate information and some people might know it, and then the prices reflect what they know and other people learn from it and blah, blah, blah. But you get the idea. It's a bit weird to say, gee, how come it seems like the yield curve is giving us information about recession? And you say, oh, it's because people see the recession coming. And that's why. So whereas it makes more sense to say, why does the yield curve seem to forecast or signal an impending recession? And say, oh, because when it inverts, that's because the Fed just slammed on the brakes. And the Fed slamming on the brakes causes a recession, right? That makes more sense. There's nothing circular about that explanation. Okay, so having said all that, well, gee, Bob, then why has the yield curve been inverted for so long this time around? And so just looking at the series, all I can say to you is, well, this time around, the Fed slammed on the brakes and the 3-month yield zoomed way up you know, shot above the 10-year. And it's just, you know, they're just hanging out like that. And so in the previous ones, like the one that I think is the most relevant, because the, you know, the pandemic, that's kind of a weird situation since there was such an external intervention. But what I think is a better model for this time around is going into, you know, going from the housing bubble into the financial crisis. And so there, yeah, the Fed raised rates, then they leveled off, and the 10-year briefly jumped above the 3-month, and then, you know, they both started falling aggressively, but the 3-month falling more so, and the recession began. So here, I think, it's just simply that the Fed raised rates so aggressively, the gap between the 3-month and the 10-year is so high right now that even though the 10-year, actually, as I'm looking at this, the 10-year actually did spike going from, what is this? April 2023 up to, when is that? September 2023, the yield on the 10-year actually did zoom way up, and then it kind of came down again. But it didn't surpass the 3-month. So I think that's part of what happened is because they tightened so aggressively, the 3-month shot so much above the 10-year that even though the 10-year did pop, it didn't get back above water, as it were. Whereas in previous cycles, when the Fed jacked up rates, the 3-month only went up above the 10-year a little bit. And so then if the 10-year popped, the yield curve would go back to normal. And then there, you know, and then things would just collapse and the recession starts. All right. So I think that's partly what's going on here. So big conclusion is like, all right, Bob, yeah, it's a lot of talking. Put your money where your mouth is. Give us something to go on here that you can at least be wrong later. So I still think everything is in store as the emperor foresaw, because if you think about it, suppose I'm right, and the reason for that historical correlation, the reason that the yield curve inversion, quote, signals a recession is basically because, you know, the Misesian boom-bust theory. So there, what 10-year rates do, that's not really relevant. Really, the issue is the fact that the movement in short-term interest rates is sort of the flip side of the Fed either dumping money in or slamming on the brakes in terms of money creation. And so if we look, this is the last chart we'll go through if you're following along on the video. The last one I look at is I plotted the unemployment rate against the effective federal funds rate. And so there what happened is, again, let's just look at the going into the financial crisis, the, you know, the so-called Great Recession, because I think that's more indicative of a normal boom bust pattern, because the pandemic is nutty with, you know, unemployment zoomed way up and everything because they told people they had to stay home. So going into the financial crisis, the Fed raised the effective federal funds rate steadily, you know, from June of 2004. The Fed started raising rates and it peaked, the effective federal funds rate, in July of 2006, okay, and at 5.3.1%. And then it held it there. It bounced around a little bit in the middle period, but it was basically at that same level all the way through June of 2007. Sorry, July of 2007. It's hard on this chart to, yeah. Through July of 2007, it ended at 5.2.8%. Okay, so basically, like I said, in the middle there, it bounced around for a couple of months, but it was basically a flat line from July of 2006 through July of 2007. All right, so they held it there for a year, and then they started aggressively cutting. And the unemployment rate was drifting down during the housing bubble years as they were raising rates, and then it troughed in the middle of that. But, you know, when they were holding the rate steady that I just told you, so like around January 2007 is when the unemployment rate troughed, and then it started ticking up, and then it really started zooming up around, I don't know, early 2008, even though the recession officially was clocked to have begun in December of 2007, okay? So what does that mean for our time around? If our cycle is the same, well, the Fed began raising interest rates aggressively, and it peaked, you know, it held pat starting it in July of 2003, where rates topped out at 5.33%, right? So only 2 basis points different from what it was in the previous, you know, the little cycle I just told you about. And again, notice it was July, all right? And so what does that mean? And, you know, it's held in there since, been completely steady. So that means if the cycle is exactly the same as it was back going into the financial crisis, we would expect the Fed to hold rates steady at 5.33% through July of 2024 and then start cutting. And then you would see unemployment, you know, as of right now, it should have already been ticking up. And guess what? It is ticking up. All right, it was 3.5% back in July, and now it's 3.9 or 3.8. All right, so it is slightly higher now than it was 6 months ago. So if it kept going up, or, you know, if it stayed the same and kept going up a little bit, you know, every other month or so, that's totally consistent with what happened last time. And right now, if the Fed just holds rates steady and doesn't start cutting until August of 2024, that lines up perfectly with what happened going into the Great Recession, right? So the fact that right now it's April and the Fed hasn't started cutting rates and people are running victory laps like MMT types and Krugmanites and such, saying, see, we told you, inflation was transitory. All these doom and gloomers, Larry Summers, and of course all the idiots at Fox News and, you know, Ron Paul types and those morons who are perma bears, they were all warning you that the inverted yield curve was going to lead to recession. They're clearly wrong. And I say, no, this is exactly what the cycle looked like before the financial crisis hit. So I didn't just prove to you that we're right. So notice the difference between me and Kelton. If I were Stephanie Kelton, I would say the numbers are clearly kind to the hypothesis that the recession's already begun. Or you see what I'm saying? So I'm not here claiming, I'm not running a victory lap. I'm just not throwing in the towel. I'm saying, wait a minute, let's, you know, give a recession a chance. Give the yield curve a chance. It has not yet begun to fight. All right? So I'm just saying, am I nervous right now? Like, uh-oh, am I sweating bullets? Because, I mean, it's kind of weird. On the one hand, it'd be great if we didn't have a financial crash. And then I say, oh, okay, I was wrong. Thank goodness it'd be like in 12 Monkeys when he just says, oh, phew, I was crazy. But no, I'm saying right now, yeah, I could be wrong. I'm not telling you all. I guarantee this is that I'm right in this. Otherwise, I'm going to resign from economics. But I'm saying, no, I'm not at all embarrassed or worried by these numbers. This is exactly what the situation looked like on the eve of the great financial crisis, or the great recession, I should say, the global financial crisis. Okay? And again, just the take home, even if the Fed keeps rates steady through July of 2024, so May comes, June comes, July comes, and they still haven't cut, it's not like, well, geez, Bob, I bet you're, the more time passes, the more stupid you look. No, that's entirely consistent. If they don't cut as of August, then the economy has lasted longer this cycle than it did back in 2007. All right. But up until through July, if the Fed holds rates steady, that doesn't disprove anything. And if the unemployment rate stays below 4% too, that doesn't. So by the way, the unemployment rate was higher in absolute terms, but I'm just talking about, you know, it coming down and then troughing and then going back up again. The pattern right now is very similar to what it was back then. Again, the absolute level is lower, but the pattern is the same. So I don't, it's not that I need unemployment to be above 5% by September or else I look foolish. No. All that needs to happen is the unemployment rate starts ticking up, perhaps gently, and then the Fed starts cutting by August. And then if the Fed then starts aggressively cutting by, you know, like October, and then unemployment rate really starts rising by December, and then there ends up being a really bad recession clocked in either fourth quarter this year or first quarter 2025, that will actually line up well with the data. Okay. And so again, in that kind of a scenario, so clearly I had said before that I thought the recession would officially start in 2024. So the recession doesn't officially start until 2025. And again, like, you know, as of the year 2026, when they look backwards and tell us, I definitely would have said, you know, an earlier time frame. And there, you know, the mistake is mine. I should have been more careful in what I said. But the mistake would be I thought the yield curve wouldn't stay this inverted this long. But if instead I looked at the thing that I thought was more precise, which namely the short-term interest rate, that is entirely consistent with a recession, you know, not starting until the first quarter of 2025. If that's what happens, it's not like after the fact people are going to say, oh yeah, the yield curve inversion normally was a good signal, but it was all kind of screwed up. And that would fit. Okay. So big picture, I still think we're on track to see a recession that officially is clocked as beginning in the fourth quarter of 2024. I guess they actually do it by month. So I haven't gotten precise enough, and also that'd be kind of silly. Like, it's not going to be down to the month. But certainly, I think everything is still on track for a recession to officially begin fourth quarter 2024. Okay. Thanks, everybody, for your attention. I'll see you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.